Chapter 17, Manifest Destiny and Its Legacy, 1841 to 1848. Territorial expansion dominated American diplomacy and politics in the 1840s. Settlers swarming into the still-disputed Oregon country aggravated relationships with Britain, which had staked its own claims in the Pacific Northwest. The clamor to annex Texas to the Union provoked bitter tension with Mexico, which continued to regard Texas as a Mexican province in revolt. And when Americans began casting a covetous eye on Mexico's northern province, the great prize of California, open warfare erupted between the United States and its southern neighbor. Victory over Mexico added vast new domains to the United States, but it also raised a thorny question about the status of slavery in the newly acquired territories, a question that would be answered in blood in the Civil War of the 1860s. The Ascension of Tyler II. A horde of hard ciderites descended upon Washington early in 1841. Clamoring for the spoils of office, newly elected President Benjamin Harrison, bewildered by the uproar, was almost hounded to death by Whig spoilsmen. The real leaders of the Whig Party regarded old Tippecanoe as little more than an impressive figure. Daniel Webster, as Secretary of State, and Henry Clay, the uncrowned king of the Whigs, and their ablest spokesman in the Senate, would grasp the helm. The aging general was finally forced to rebuke the overzealous Clay and pointedly remind him that he, William Henry Harrison, was President of the United States. Unluckily for Clay and Webster, their schemes soon hit a fatal snag. Before the new term had fairly started, Harrison contracted pneumonia. Wearied by official functions and plagued by office seekers, the enfeebled old warrior died after only 4 weeks in the White House, by far the shortest administration in American history, following by far the longest inaugural address. The Tyler II part of the Whig ticket, hitherto only a rhyme, now claimed the spotlight. For my readers, we skimmed over this last part in the last election, but in 1840, William Henry Harrison and John Tyler won the election, and their slogan was Tippecanoe and Tyler II, because William Henry Harrison was the famous general that won the Battle of Tippecanoe. And, you know, John Tyler, too. And this was an 1840 election. It came after Martin Van Buren. And this was an election that they called the Log Cabin and Hard Cider Campaign, because both sides tried to appeal to the masses, and particularly the frontiersmen and the Western electorate, which represents kind of one of the continuing shift towards a popular election with expanded suffrage. And no more can you only considered the elites. You had to be a frontiersman, you had to be one of the people. And so they basically argued that William Henry Harrison could handle his hard cider and came from a log cabin, even though that wasn't true. Okay, so William Henry Harrison has a really long inaugural address in January. It's really cold outside, catches pneumonia, and dies. And so now the Vice President, John Tyler, becomes president. So back to the reading. The Tyler II part of the Whig ticket, hitherto only a rhyme, now claimed the spotlight. What manner of man did the nation now find in the presidential chair? 6 feet tall, slender, blue-eyed, and fair-haired, with classical features and a high forehead, John Tyler was a Virginia gentleman of the old school, gracious and kindly, yet stubbornly attached to principle. He had earlier resigned from the Senate, quite unnecessarily, rather than accept distasteful instructions from the Virginia legislature. Still a lone wolf, he had forsaken the Jacksonian Democratic fold for that of the Whigs, largely because he could not stomach the dictatorial tactics of Jackson. Tyler's enemies accused him of being a Democrat in Whig clothing, but this charge was only partially true. The Whig Party, like the Democratic Party, was something of a catch-all, and the accidental president belonged to the minority wing, which embraced a number of Jeffersonian states' writers. Tyler had, in fact, been put on the ticket partly to attract the vote of this fringe group, many of whom were influential Southern gentry. Yet Tyler, high-minded as he was, should never have consented to run on the ticket. Although the dominant Clay Webster group had published no platform, every alert politician knew what the unpublished platform contained. On virtually every major issue, the obstinate Virginia was at odds with the majority of his adopted Whig Party, which was pro-bank, pro-tariff, and pro-internal improvements. Tyler, too, rhymed with Tippecanoe, but there the harmony ended. As events turned out, President Harrison, the Whig, served only 4 weeks, whereas Tyler, the ex-Democrat, who was still largely a Democrat at heart, served for 204 weeks. I'm going to pause one more time here. I promise I won't keep doing this, but for my folks, we did not read the last section of chapter 13, so I want to make sure you guys are clear on this new two-party system. We now have the Democrats and the Whigs. This is the new two-party system that forms out of after Jackson, basically, in the 1830s. And they're both national parties. The Democrats and the Whigs, they both grew out of this idea, the heritage of the Jeffersonian republicanism, but they each laid claim to a different part of the Republican inheritance, the small R Republican, the idea of a republic. The Jacksonian Democrats, they glorified the liberty of the individual, and they fiercely guarded what they saw as privilege in government. The Whigs, they trumpeted the national harmony of society and the value of community, and they were willing to use the government to realize their objectives. The Whigs also berated those leaders, and they considered Jackson to be one of these whose appeal to self-interest fostered conflict among individuals and classes and sections, so they're big on harmony. On the other hand, Democrats, they clung to the states' rights and restraining the federal government in social and economic affairs. The Whigs, as the book just said, tended to favor a renewed national bank, protective tariffs, internal improvements, public schools, increasingly moral reforms such as the prohibition of liquor, and even maybe the abolition of slavery. So the Whigs are kind of riding that wave of reform. Democrats are states' rights. So John Tyler, who was recently on the Whig ticket, still on the Whig ticket, but he really was just recently a Democrat. So they're concerned about how he's really going to act now that he's president. So let's go back to the reading. John Tyler, a president without a party. After their hard-won, hard-cider victory, the Whigs brought their not-so-secret platform out of Clay's waistcoat pocket. To the surprise of no one, it outlined a strongly nationalistic, again, anti-states writers program. Number one, financial reform came first. The Whig Congress hastened to pass a law ending the independent treasury, and President Tyler disarmingly agreed to sign it. Clay next drove through Congress a a fiscal bank, which would establish a new bank of the United States. Tyler's hostility to a centralized bank was notorious, and Clay, the great compromiser, would have done well to conciliate him. But the Kentuckian, robbed repeatedly of the presidency by lesser men, was in an imperious mood and riding for a fall. When the bank bill reached the president's desk, Tyler flatly vetoed it on practical and constitutional grounds. A drunken mob gathered late at night near the White House and shouted insultingly, "Huzzah for Clay! A bank! Down with a veto!" The stunned Whig leaders tried once again. Striving to pacify Tyler's objections to a fiscal bank, they passed another bill providing for a fiscal corporation. But the president, still unbending, vetoed the offensive substitute. The Democrats were jubilant. They had been saved from another financial monster, only by the pneumonia that had felled Harrison. Whig extremists, seething with indignation, condemned Tyler as his accidency and as an executive ass. Wildly burned in effigy, he received numerous letters threatening him with death. A wave of influenza then sweeping the country was called the Tyler Gripe. To the delight of the Democrats, the stiff-necked Virginian was formally expelled from his party by a caucus of Whig congressmen, and a serious attempt to impeach him was broached in the House of Representatives. His entire cabinet resigned in body, except Secretary of State Webster, who was then in the midst of delicate negotiations with England. The proposed Whig tariff also felt the prick of the president's well-inked pen. Tyler appreciated the necessity of bringing additional revenue to the Treasury, but old Democrat that he was, he looked with a frosty eye on the major tariff scheme of the Whigs, because it provided, among other features, for a distribution among the states of revenue from the sale of public lands in the West. Tyler could see no point in squandering federal money when the federal treasury was not overflowing, and he again wielded an emphatic veto. Chase and Clayettes redrafted their tariff bill. They chopped out the offensive dollar distribution scheme and pushed down the rates to about the moderately protective tariff level of 1832, roughly 32% on dutiable goods. Tyler had no fondness for a protective tariff, but realizing the need for additional revenue, he reluctantly signed the law of 1842. In subsequent months, the pressure for higher customs duties slackened as the country gradually edged its way out of the Depression. The Whig slogan, "Harrison, $2 a day in roast beef," was reduced by unhappy Democrats to 10 cents a day in bean soup. A war of words with Britain. Hatred of Britain during the 19th century came to a head periodically and had to be lanced by a treaty settlement or by war. The poison had festered ominously by 1842. Anti-British passions were composed of many ingredients. At bottom lay the bitter, red-coated memories of the two Anglo-American wars. In addition, the genteel pro-British Federalists had died out, eventually yielding to the boisterous Jacksonian Democrats. British travelers, sniffling with aristocratic noses at the crude scene, wrote acidly of American tobacco spitting, slave auctioneering, lynching, eye gouging, and other unsavory features of the rustic republic. Travel books penned by these critics, whose views were avidly read on both sides of the Atlantic, stirred up angry outbursts in America. But the literary fireworks did not end here. British magazines added fuel to the flames when, enlarging on the travel books, they launched sneering attacks on Yankee shortcomings. American journals struck back with "you're another" arguments, thus touching off the Third War with England, quote-unquote. Fortunately, this British-American war was fought with paper broadsides and only ink was spilled. British authors, including Charles Dickens, entered the fray with gall-dipped pens, for they were being denied rich royalties by the absence of an American copyright law. Sprawling America, with expensive canals to dig and railroads to build, was a borrowing nation in the 19th century. Imperial Britain, with its overflowing coffers, was a lending nation. The well-heeled creditor is never popular with the down-on-the-heels debtor, and the phrase bloated British bondholder rolled bitterly from many American tongue. When the Panic of 1837 broke, and several states defaulted on their bonds or repudiated them openly, honest Englishmen assailed Yankee trickery. One of them offered a new stanza for an old song. Yankee Doodle borrows cash, Yankee Doodle spends it, and then he snaps his finger at the jolly flat who lends it. Troubles of a more dangerous sort came closer to home in 1837 when a short-lived insurrection erupted in Canada. It was supported by a small minority of Canadians that it never had a real chance of success. Yet hundreds of hot-blooded Americans, hoping to strike a blow for freedom against the hereditary enemy, furnished military supplies or volunteered for armed service. The Washington regime tried arduously, though futilely, to uphold its weak neutrality regulations. But again, as in the case of Texas, it simply could not enforce unpopular laws in the face of popular opposition. A provocative incident on the Canadian frontier brought passions to a boil in 1837. An American steamer, the Caroline, was carrying supplies to the insurgents across the swift Niagara River. It was finally attacked on the New York shore by a determined British force, which set the vessel on fire. Lurid American illustrators showed the flaming ship laden with shrieking souls plummeting over Niagara Falls. The craft, in fact, sank short of the plunge, and only one American was killed. This unlawful invasion on American soil, a counter-violation of neutrality, had alarming aftermaths. Washington officials lodged vigorous but ineffective protests. 3 years later, in 1840, the incident was dramatically revived in the state of New York. A Canadian named McLeod, after allegedly boasting in a tavern of his part in the Caroline raid, was arrested and indicted for murder. The London Foreign Office, which regarded the Caroline raiders as members of a sanctioned armed force and not as criminals, made clear that his execution would mean war. Finally, fortunately, McLeod was freed after establishing an alibi. It must have been airtight, for it was good enough to convince a New York jury. The tension forthwith eased, but it snapped taut again in 1841 when British officials in the Bahamas offered asylum to 130 Virginia slaves who had rebelled and captured the American ship Creole. Manipulating the Maine maps. An explosive controversy of the early 1840s involved the Maine boundary dispute. The St. Lawrence River is icebound several months of the year, as the British, remembering the War of 1812, well knew. They were determined, as a defensive precaution against the Yankees, to build a western road westward from the seaport of Halifax to Quebec. But the proposed road ran through the disputed territory, claimed also by Maine under the misleading peace treaty of 1783. Tough-knuckled lumberjacks from both Maine and Canada entered the dispute, and they entered the disputed no-man's land of the tall-timbered Aroostook River Valley. Ugly fights flared up, and both sides summoned the local militia. The small-scale lumberjack clash, which was dubbed the Aroostook War, threatened to widen into a full-dress shooting war. As the crisis deepened in 1842, the London Foreign Office took an unusual step. It sent to Washington a non-professional diplomat, the conciliatory financier Lord Ashburton, who had married a wealthy American woman. He speedily established cordial relationships with Secretary of State Webster, who had recently been lionized during a visit to Britain. The two statesmen, their nerves frayed by protracted negotiations in the heat of a Washington summer, finally agreed to compromise on the Maine boundary. On the basis of a rough split-the-difference arrangement, the Americans were to retain some 7,000 square miles of the 1,200 square miles of wilderness in dispute. The British got less land, but won the desired Halifax-Quebec route. During the negotiations, the Caroline affair, malingering since 1837, was patched up by an exchange of diplomatic notes. an overlooked bonus sneaked by the small print of the same treaty. The British, in adjusting the U.S.-Canadian boundary farther west, surrendered 6,500 square miles. The area was later found to contain priceless Mesabi iron ore of Minnesota. Before we go on to Texas, again from my class, we skimmed over the last section. If you want more information on Texas, you go to page 275 and 276. But basically what ends up happening in 1836, many Americans were moving into Texas, which was really a northern province of Mexico. It was not part of America. It was a northern section of Mexico. And more Americans were moving in, many of them slave owners from the South. So in the 1830s, friction develops between Mexicans and Texas over issues such as slavery, immigration, and local Texas rights, kind of like what would states' rights would be. And eventually they have a rebellion in 1836, and they declare their independence. This is where, the Alamo happens. Remember the Alamo? So you have, in a nutshell, Texas declares independence, and some of them, after declaring independence from Mexico, want to join America and be annexed into America. At the time, 1836, President Jackson refuses to touch this one because he's afraid that it will touch off full-scale war with Mexico, because Mexico really never recognized Texas independence. So now it's the 1840s, and we are going back to the question of Mexico. I'm sorry, Texas and Mexico. The Lone Star of Texas shines alone. During the uncertain 8 years since 1836, the rebellion, Texas had led a precarious existence, this fragile existence. Mexico, refusing to recognize Texas' independence, regarded the Lone Star Republic as a province in revolt to be reconquered in the future. Mexican officials loudly threatened war if the American Eagle should ever gather the fledgling republic under its protective wings. The Texans were forced to maintain a costly military establishment, vastly outnumbered by their Mexican enemy. They could not tell when he would strike again. Mexico actually did make two half-hearted raids that, though ineffectual, foreshadowed more fearsome efforts. Confronted with such perils, Texas was driven into the open negotiations with Britain and France in the hope of securing the defensive shield of a protectorate. In 1839 and 1840, the Texans concluded treaties with France, Holland, and Belgium, in the hoping that those countries would protect them. Britain was intensely interested in an independent Texas. Such a republic would check the southward surge of the American colossus, whose bulging biceps posed a constant threat to nearby British possessions in the New World. A puppet Texas, dancing to the strings pulled by Britain, could be turned upon the Yankees. Subsequent clashes would create a smokescreen diversion behind which foreign powers could move into the Americas and challenge the insolent Monroe Doctrine. French schemers were likewise attracted by the hoary game of divide and conquer. These actions would result, they hoped, in the fragmentation and militarization of America. Dangers threatened from other foreign quarters. British abolitionists were busily intriguing for a foothold in Texas. If successful in freeing a few blacks there, they presumably would inflame the nearby slaves of the South. In addition, British merchants regarded Texas as a potential important free trade area, an offset to the tariff wall of the United States. British manufacturers likewise perceived that those vast Texas plains constituted one great cotton-producing area in the future. An independent Texas would relieve British looms of their chronic dependence on American fiber, a supply that might be cut off in time of crisis by embargo or war. The belated Texas nuptials. Partly because of the fears aroused by British schemers, Texas became a leading issue in the presidential campaign of 1844. The foes of expansion assailed annexation, while Southern hotheads cried, "Texas or disunion!" The pro-expansion Democrats under James K. Polk finally triumphed over the Whigs under Henry Clay, the hardy perennial candidate. Lame duck President Tyler thereupon interpreted the narrow Democratic victory with dubious accuracy as a mandate to acquire Texas. Eager to crown his troubled administration with this splendid prize, Tyler deserves much of the credit for shepherding Texas into the fold. Many conscious Whigs feared that Texas in the Union would be red meat to nourish the lusty slave power. Aware of their opposition, Tyler despaired of securing the needed two-thirds vote for a treaty in the Senate. He therefore arranged for annexation by a joint resolution. This resolution required only a simple majority in both houses of Congress. After a spirited debate, the resolution passed early in 1845, and Texas was formally invited to become the 28th star on the American flag. Mexico angrily charged that the Americans had despoiled it of Texas. This was to some extent true in 1836, but hardly true in 1845, for the area was no longer Mexico's to be despoiled of. As the years stretched out, realistic observers could see that the Mexicans would not be able to conquer their lost province. Yet Mexico left the Texans dangling by denying their right to dispose of themselves as they chose. By 1845, the Lone Star Republic had become a dangerous spot, inviting foreign intrigue that menaced the American people. The continued existence of Texas as an independent nation threatened to involve the United States in a series of ruinous wars, both in America and in Europe. Americans were in lick all creation mood when they sang Uncle Sam's song to Miss Texas. If Mexi, backed by secret foes, still talks of getting you, gal, why, we can lick 'em all, you know, and then annex 'em too, gal. It's a great song. What other power would have spurned the imperial domain of Texas? The bride was so near, so rich, so fair, so willing. Whatever the peculiar circumstances of the Texas Revolution, the United States can hardly be accused of unseemly haste in achieving annexation. 9 long years were surely a decent wait between the beginning of the courtship and the consummation of the marriage. Oregon fever populates Oregon. The so-called Oregon country was an enormous wilderness. It sprawled magnificently west of the Rockies to the Pacific Ocean, and north of California to the line of 54 degrees 40, the present southern tip of the Alaskan Panhandle. All or substantial parts of this immense area were claimed at one time or another by 4 nations, Spain, Russia, Britain, and the United States. 2 claimants dropped out of the scramble. Spain, though the first to raise its banner in Oregon, bartered away its claims to the United States in the so-called Florida Treaty of 1890. Russia retreated to the line of 5440 by the treaties of 1824 and 25 with America and Britain. These 2 remaining rivals now had the field to themselves. British claims to Oregon were strong, at least that the portion north of the Columbia River. They were based squarely on prior discovery and exploration on treaty rights and on actual occupation. The most important colonizing agency was the far-flung Hudson Bay Company, which was trading profitably with the Indians of the Pacific Northwest for furs. This is the British side. Americans, for their part, could also point pridefully to exploration and occupation. Captain Robert Gray, in 1792, had stumbled upon the majestic Columbia River, which he named after his ship, and then the famed Lewis and Clark expedition of 1804-1806 had ranged overland through the Oregon country to the Pacific. This shaky American toehold was ultimately strengthened by the presence of missionaries and other settlers, a sprinkling of whom reached the grassy Willamette Valley south of the Columbia in the 1830s. These men and women of God, in saving the soul of the Indian, were instrumental in saving the soil of Oregon for the United States. They stimulated interest in faraway domains that countless Americans had earlier assumed would not be settled for centuries. Scattered American and British pioneers in Oregon continued to live peacefully side by side. At the time of the negotiating the Treaty of 1818, the United States had sought to divide the vast large domain at the 49th parallel. But the British, who regarded the Columbia River as the St. Lawrence of the West, were unwilling to yield this vital artery. A scheme for peaceful joint occupation was thereby adopted, pending future settlement. The handful of Americans in the Willamette Valley was suddenly multiplied in the early 1840s when Oregon fever seized hundreds of restless pioneers. In increasing numbers, their creaking-covered wagons jolted over the 2,000-mile Oregon Trail as the human rivulet widened into a stream. By 1846, about 5,000 Americans had settled south of the Columbia River, some of them tough border ruffians, expert with a bowie knife and revolving pistol. The British, in the face of this rising torrent of humanity, could muster only 700 or so subjects north of the Columbia. Losing out lopsidedly in the population race, they were beginning to see the wisdom of arriving at a peaceful settlement before being engulfed by their neighbors. The curious fact is that only a relatively small segment of the Oregon country was in actual controversy by 1845. The area in dispute consisted of the rough quadrangle between the Columbia River on the south and east, the 49th parallel on the north, and the Pacific on the west. Britain had repeatedly offered the line of the Columbia. America had repeatedly offered the 49th parallel. The whole fateful issue was now tossed into the presidential election of 1844, where it was largely overshadowed by the question of annexing Texas, joining them to the U.S. A mandate, for Manifest Destiny? The 2 major parties nominated their presidential standard-bearers in May 1844. Ambitious, but often frustrated, Henry Clay, easily the most popular man in the country, was enthusiastically chosen by the Whigs at Baltimore. The Democrats, meeting there later, seemed hopelessly deadlocked. Finally, the expansionists, dominated by the pro-Texas Southerners, trotted out and nominated James K. Polk of Tennessee, America's first dark horse or surprise presidential candidate. Polk may have been a dark horse, but he was hardly an unknown or a decrepit nag. Speaker of the House of Representatives for 4 years and governor of Tennessee for 2 terms, he was a determined, industrious, ruthless, and intelligent public servant. Sponsored by Andrew Jackson, his friend and neighbor, he was rather implausibly touted by the Democrats as yet another young hickory. Whigs attempted to jeer him into oblivion with the taunt, "Who is James K. Polk?" They soon found out. The campaign of 1844 was in part an expression of the mighty emotional upsurge known as Manifest Destiny. Countless citizens in the 1840s and 1850s, feeling a sense of mission, believed that Almighty God had manifestly destined the American people for a hemispheric career. They would irresistibly spread their uplifting and ennobling democratic institutions over at least the entire continent, and possibly over South America as well. Land greed and ideals, empire and liberty, were thus conveniently conjoined. Expansionist Democrats were strongly swayed by the intoxicating spell of Manifest Destiny. They came out flat-footedly in their platform for re-annexation of Texas and the reoccupation of Oregon, all the way to the 54-40 line. Out-bellowing the Whig log cabinites in the name of slogans, game of slogans, they shouted, "All of Oregon or none." They also condemned Clay as a corrupt bargainer, a dissolute character, and a slave owner. Now, their own candidate, Polk, also owned slaves, a classic case of the pot calling the kettle black. The Whigs, as noisemakers, took no backseat. They countered with such slogans as "Hooray for Clay and Polk, Slavery and Texas," or "Clay, Union and Liberty." They also spread the lie that a gang of Tennessee slaves had been seen on their way to a southern slave market branded with the initials JKP, or James K. Polk. On the crucial issue of Texas, the acrobatic Clay tried to ride 2 horses at once. The great compromiser appears to have compromised away the presidency when he wrote a series of confusing letters. They seem to say that while he personally favored annexing slaveholding Texas, an appeal to the South, he also favored postponement, an appeal to the North. He might have lost more ground if he had not straddled, but he certainly alienated more ardent anti-slaveryites. In the stretch drive, Dark Horse Polk nipped Henry Clay at the wire, 170 to 105 votes in the Electoral College, and 1,364,000 to 1,300,097 in the popular column. Clay would have won if he had not lost New York State by a scant 5,000 votes. There, the tiny anti-slavery Liberty Party absorbed nearly 16,000 votes, many of which would have otherwise have gone to the unlucky Kentuckian. Ironically, the anti-Texas Liberty Party, by spoiling Clay's chances and helping to ensure the election of pro-Texas Polk, hastened the annexation. Hungry Democrats, flushed with victory, proclaimed that they had received a mandate from the voters to take Texas. But a presidential election is seldom, if ever, a clear-cut mandate on anything. The only way to secure a true reflection of the voters' will, is to hold a special election on a given issue. The picture that emerged in 1844 is one not of mandate, but muddle. What else could there have been when the results were so close, the personalities so colorful, and the issues so numerous, including Oregon, Texas, the tariff, slavery, the bank, and internal improvements? Yet this unclear mandate was interpreted by President Tyler as a crystal-clear charge to annex Texas, and he signed the joint resolution 3 days before leaving the White House. Polk the Purposeful. Young Hickory Polk, unlike old Hickory Jackson, was not an impressive figure. Of middle height, 5'8", lean, white-haired, worn long, gray-eyed and stern-faced, he took life seriously and drove himself mercilessly into a premature grave. His burdens were increased by an unwillingness to delegate authority. Methodical and hard-working, but not brilliant, he was shrewd, narrow-minded, conscientious, and persistent. "What he went for, he fetched," wrote a contemporary. Purposeful in the highest degree, he developed a positive four-point program and with remarkable success achieved it completely in less than 4 years. One of Polk's goals was a lower tariff. His Secretary of the Treasury, Wispy Robert Walker, devised a tariff for revenue bill that reduced the average rate to the tariff of 1842 from about 32% to 25%. With the strong support of lower tariff Southerners,
Walker lobbied the measure through Congress, though not without loud complaints from the Clayites, especially in New England and the Middle States, that American manufacturing would be ruined. But these prophets of doom missed the mark. The Walker Tariff of 1846 proved to be an excellent revenue producer, largely because it was followed by boom times and heavy imports. A second objective of Polk was the restoration of the independent treasury, unceremoniously dropped by the Whigs in 1841. Pro-bank Whigs in Congress raised a storm of opposition, but victory at last rewarded the president's efforts in 1846. The third and fourth points on Polk's must list were the acquisition of California and the settlement of the Oregon dispute. Reoccupation of the whole of Oregon had been promised Northern Democrats in the campaign of 1844, but Southern Democrats, once they annexed Texas, rapidly cooled off. Polk, himself a Southerner, had no intention of insisting on the 54-40 pledge of his own platform, but feeling bound by the three offers of his predecessors to London, he again proposed the compromise line of 49 degrees. The British minister in Washington, on his own initiative, brusquely spurned this olive branch. You can see on the map the lines they're talking about. The next move on the Oregon chessboard was up to Britain. Fortunately for peace, the ministry began to experience a change of heart. British anti-expansionists, Little Englanders, were now persuaded that the Columbia River was not, after all, the St. Lawrence of the West, and that the turbulent American hordes might one day seize the Oregon country. Why fight a hazardous war over this wilderness on behalf of an unpopular monopoly, the Hudson Bays Company, which had already furred out much of the area anyhow? Early in 1846, the British hat in hand came around and themselves proposed the line of 49 degrees. President Polk, irked by the previous rebuff, threw the decision squarely into the lap of the Senate. The senators speedily accepted the offer and approved the subsequent treaty, despite a few diehard shouts of 54-40 forever, and every foot or not an inch. The fact that the United States was then a month deep in a war with Mexico doubtless influenced the Senate's final vote. Satisfaction with the Oregon settlement among Americans was not unanimous. The northwestern states, hotbed of manifest destiny and 54-40ism, joined the anti-slavery forces in condemning what they regarded as a base betrayal by the South. Why all of Texas, but not all of Oregon? Because, retorted the expansionist Senator Benton of Missouri, Great Britain is powerful and Mexico is weak. So Polk, despite all the campaign bluster, got neither a 54-40 nor a fight. But he did get something that in the long run was better, a reasonable compromise without a rifle being raised. Misunderstandings with Mexico. Faraway California was another worry of Polk's. He and other disciples of Manifest Destiny had long coveted its verdant valleys, and especially the spacious Bay of San Francisco. This splendid harbor was widely regarded as America's future gateway to the Pacific Ocean. The population of California in 1845 was curiously mixed. It consisted of perhaps 13,000 sun-blessed Spanish Mexicans and as many as 75,000 dispirited Indians. There were fewer than 1,000, quote, foreigners, mostly Americans, some of whom had left their consciousness behind them as they rounded the Cape Horn. Given time, these transplanted Yankees might yet bring California into the Union by playing the Texas game. Texas game was the belief that you had a bunch of Americans who moved to Texas say, hey, we want independence from Mexico, and then break off and form their own country and join America eventually. The thought was maybe if enough Americans moved to California, they could claim independence from Mexico and then join the U.S. Polk was eager to buy California from Mexico, but relations with Mexico City were dangerously embittered. Among other friction points, the United States had claims against the Mexicans for some $3 million in damages to American citizens and their property. The revolution-riddled regime in Mexico had formally agreed to assume most of this debt, but had been forced to default on its payments. A more serious bone of contention was Texas. The Mexican government, after threatening war if the United States should acquire the Lone Star Republic, had recalled its ministers from Washington following annexation. Diplomatic relations were completely severed. Deadlock with Mexico over Texas was further tightened by a question of boundaries. During the long era of Spanish-Mexican occupation, the southwestern boundary of Texas had been the Nueces River, but the expansive Texas on rather far-fetched grounds were claiming that the more southerly Rio Grande was their border instead. Polk, for his part, felt a strong moral obligation to defend Texas in its claim once it was annexed. So basically, Mexicans think it's there's one river, the Americans say it's the Rio Grande, which would make Texas bigger, and that there's a border dispute. The Mexicans were far less concerned about this boundary quibble than was the United States. In their eyes, all of Texas was still theirs, although temporarily in revolt, and a dispute over the two rivers seemed pointless. Yet Polk was careful to keep American troops out of virtually all the explosive no-man's lands between the Nueces and the Rio Grande, as long as there was any real prospect of peaceful adjustment. The Golden Prize of California continued to cause Polk much anxiety. Disquieting rumors, now known to have been ill-founded, were circulating that Britain was about to buy or seize California, a grab that Americans could not tolerate under the Monroe Doctrine. In a last desperate throw of the dice, Polk dispatched John Slidell to Mexico City as minister late in 1845. The new envoy, among other alternatives, was instructed to offer a maximum of $25 million for California and territory to the east. But the proud Mexican people would not even permit Slidell to present his insulting proposition. American blood on American soil? A frustrated Polk was now prepared to force a showdown. On January 13, 1846, he ordered 4,000 men under General Zachary Taylor to march from the Nueces River to the Rio Grande, provocatively near Mexican forces. Polk's presidential diary reveals that he expected at any moment to hear of a clash. When none occurred after an anxious wait, he informed his cabinet on May 9, 1846, that he proposed to ask Congress to declare war on the basis of 1. Unpaid claims, and 2. Slidell's rejection. These, at best, were rather flimsy pretexts. Two cabinet members spoke up and said that they would feel better satisfied if Mexican troops should fire the first shot. That very evening, as fate would have it, news of bloodshed arrived. On April 25, 1846, Mexican troops had crossed the Rio Grande and attacked General Taylor's command with a loss of 16 Americans killed or wounded. So quick pause here, right? Polk wants California. Mexico says, get out of here. We're not selling it to you. So Polk says, all right, we got to find a way to go to war with Mexico so we can have an excuse to kind of snag more land. And he's hoping that if they have troops provocatively near Mexican troops, something will happen and then he can blame Mexico for starting the war. Polk, further aroused, sent a vigorous war message to Congress. He declared that despite all our best efforts to avoid a clash, hostilities had been forced upon the country by the shedding of American blood upon the American soil. A patriotic Congress overwhelmingly voted for war, and enthusiastic volunteers cried, "Ho for the halls of Montezuma's, or in Mexico or death." Inflamed by the war fever, even anti-slavery Whig bastions melted and joined the rest of the nation, though they later condemned Jimmy Polk's war. As James Russell Lowell of Massachusetts lamented, "Massachusetts, God forgive her, she's a-keeling with the raw rest." She's a-keeling with the rest. In his message to Congress, Polk was making history, not writing it. If he had been an historian, he would have explained that American blood had been shed on soil that the Mexicans had good reason to regard as their own. A gangling, rough-featured Whig congressman from Illinois, one Abraham Lincoln, introduced certain resolutions that requested information as to the precise spot on the American soil where American blood had been shed. He pushed his spot resolutions with such persistence that he became known as the Spotty Lincoln, who could die of spotted fever. The more extreme anti-slavery agitators of the North, many of them Whigs, branded the president a liar, Polk the mendacious. Did Polk provoke war? Mexico was an imperative point in his program, and Mexico would not sell it at any price. The only way to get it was to use force or wait for an internal American revolt. Yet delay seemed dangerous, for the claws of the British lion might snatch up the ripening California fruit from the talons of the American eagle. Grievances against Mexico were annoying, yet tolerable. In later years, America endured even worse ones. But in 1846, patience had ceased to be a virtue, as far as Polk was concerned. Bent on grasping California for fair means or foul, he pushed the quarrel to a bloody showdown. Both sides, in fact, were spoiling for a fight. Feisty Americans, especially southwestern expansionists, were eager to teach the Mexicans a lesson. The Mexicans, in turn, were burning to humiliate the bullies of the North. Possessing a considerable standing army, heavily overstaffed with generals, they boasted of invading the United States, freeing the black slaves, and lassoing whole segments of Americans. They had already ended slavery years before, the Mexicans. They were hoping that the quarrel with Britain over Oregon would blossom into a full-dress war, and as it came near doing, and further pin down the hated Yankees. A conquest of Mexico's vast and arid expanses seemed fantastic, especially in view of the bulging American invasion of Canada in 1812. Both sides were fired by moral indignation. The Mexican people could fight with the flaming sword of righteousness, for had they not for had not the insolent Yankee picked a fight by polluting their soil? Many earnest Americans, on the other hand, sincerely believed that Mexico was the aggressor. The mastering of Mexico. Polk wanted California, not war, but when war came, he hoped to fight it on a limited scale and then pull out when he had captured the prize. The dethroned Mexican dictator Santa Anna, then exiled with his teenage bride in Cuba, let it be known that if the American blockading squadron would permit him to slip into Mexico, he would sell out his country. Incredibly, Polk agreed to this discreditable intrigue. But the double-crossing Santa Anna, once he returned to Mexico, proceeded to rally his countrymen to a desperate defense of their soil. American operations in the Southwest and in California were completely successful. In 1846, General Stephen Kearny led a detachment of 1,700 troops over the famous Santa Fe Trail from Fort Leavenworth to Santa Fe. This sun-baked outpost with its drowsy plazas was easily captured. But before Kearny could reach California, the fertile Providence was won. When war broke out, Captain John C. Fremont, the dashing explorer, just happened to be there with several dozen well-armed men. In helping to overthrow Mexican rule in 1846, he collaborated with American naval officers and with local Americans who had hoisted the banner of the short-lived California Bear Flag Republic. They snapped California. General Zachary Taylor, meanwhile, had been spearheading the main thrust. Known as Old Rough and Ready because of his iron constitution and incredibly unsoldierly appearance, he sometimes wore a Mexican straw hat. He fought his way across the Rio Grande into Mexico. After several gratifying victories, he reached Buena Vista. There, on February 22nd, 23rd, and 1847, his weakened force of 5,000 men was attacked by some 20,000 march-weary troops under Santa Anna. The Mexicans were finally repulsed with extreme difficulty, and overnight, Zachary Taylor became the hero of Buena Vista. One Kentuckian was heard to say that old Zach would be elected president in 1848 by spontaneous combustion. Sound American strategy now called for a crushing blow at the enemy's vitals, Mexico City. General Taylor, though a good leader of modest-sized forces, could not win decisively in the semi-deserts of northern Mexico. The command of the main expedition, which pushed inland from the coastal city of Veracruz early in 1847, was entrusted to General Winfield Scott. A handsome giant of a man, Scott had emerged as a hero from the War of 1812 and had later earned the nickname Old Fuss and Feathers because of his resplendent uniforms and strict discipline. He was severely handicapped in the Mexican campaign by inadequate numbers of troops, by expiring enlistments, by a more numerous enemy, by mountainous terrain, by disease, and by political backbiting at home. Yet he succeeded in battling his way up to Mexico City by September 1847. In one of the most brilliant campaigns in American military annals. He proved to be the most distinguished general produced by his country between 1783 and 1861. Fighting for peace. Polk was anxious to end the shooting as soon as he could secure his territorial goals. Accordingly, he sent along with Scott's invading army the chief clerk of the State Department, Nicholas Trist, who, among other weaknesses, was afflicted with an overfluid pen. Trist and Scott arranged for an armistice and stop fighting with Santa Anna, at a cost of $10,000. The wily dictator pocketed the bribe and then used the time to bolster his defenses. Negotiating a treaty with a sword in one hand and a pen in the other was ticklish business. Polk, disgusted with his blundering envoy, abruptly recalled Trist. The wordy diplomat then dashed off a 65-page letter explaining why he was not coming home. The president was furious, but Trist, grasping a fleeting opportunity to negotiate, signed the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo on February 2, 1848, and forwarded it to Washington. The terms of the treaty were breathtaking. They could, one, confirm the American title to Texas, and yield an enormous area stretching westward to Oregon and the ocean, and embracing coveted California. This total expense, including Texas, was about one-half of Mexico. The United States agreed to pay $15 million for the land and to assume the claims of its citizens against Mexico in the amount of $3,250,000. Polk submitted the treaty to the Senate. Although Trist had proved highly annoying, he had generally followed his original instructions, and speed was of essence, was imperative. The anti-slavery Whigs in Congress, dubbed the Mexican Whigs or Conscious Whigs, were denouncing this damnable war with increasing heat. Having secured control of the House in 1847, they were even threatening to vote down supplies for the armies in the field. If they had done so, Scott probably would have been forced to retreat, and the fruits of victory might have been tossed away. Another peril impended. A swelling group of expansionists, intoxicated by manifest destiny, was clamoring for all of Mexico. If America had seized it, the nation would have been saddled with an expensive and vexatious policing problem. Far-seeing Southerners like Calhoun, alarmed by the mounting anger of anti-slavery agitators, realized that the South would do well not to be too greedy. The treaty was finally approved by the Senate, 38-14. Oddly enough, it was condemned both by those opponents who wanted all of Mexico and by opponents who wanted none of it. Victors rarely pay an indemnity, especially after a costly conflict has been, quote, forced on them. Yet Polk, who had planned to offer $25 million before fighting the war, arranged to pay $18,250,000 after winning it. Cynics have charged that the Americans were prickled by guilty consciousness. Apologists have pointed proudly to the Anglo-Saxon spirit of fair play. A decisive factor was the need for haste. While there was still a responsible Mexican government to carry out the treaty, and before political foes in the United States, notably the anti-slavery zealots, sabotaged Polk's expansionist program. Profit and loss in Mexico. As wars go, the Mexican War was a small one. It cost some 13,000 American lives, most of them taken by disease. But the fruits of the fighting were enormous. America's total expanse, already vast, was increased by about one-third, counting Texas, an addition even greater than that of the Louisiana Purchase. A sharp stimulus was given to the spirit of manifest destiny, for as the proverb has it, the appetite comes with eating. As fate ordained, the Mexican War was the blood-spattered schoolroom of the Civil War. This is huge, folks. The campaigns provided priceless field experiences for most of the officers destined to become leading generals in the forthcoming conflict, including Captain Robert E. Lee and Lieutenant Ulysses S. Grant. The Military Academy of West Point, founded in 1802, fully justified its existence through the well-trained officers. Useful also was the Navy, which did valuable work in throwing a crippling blockade around Mexican ports. The Marine Corps, in existence since 1798, won new laurels and to this day sings in its stirring hymn about the halls of Montezuma. The Army waged war without defeat and without a major blunder, despite formidable obstacles and a half dozen or so achingly long marches. Chagrined British critics, as well as other foreign skeptics, reluctantly revised upward their estimate of Yankee military prowess. Opposing armies, moreover, emerged with increased respect for each other. The Mexicans, though poorly led, fought heroically. At Chapultepec, near Mexico City, the teenage lads of the military academy there, Los Niños, perished to a boy. Long-memoried Mexicans have never forgotten that their northern enemy tore away about half of their country. The argument that they were lucky not to lose all of it, and that they had been paid something for the land, has scarcely lessened their bitterness. The war also marked an ugly turning point in the relationships between the United States and Latin America as a whole. Hitherto, Uncle Sam had been regarded with some complacency, even friendliness. Henceforth, he was increasingly feared as the, quote, colossus of the North. Suspicious neighbors to the South condemned him as a greedy and untrustworthy bully, who might next despoil them of their soil. Most ominous of all, the war re-aroused the snarling dog of the slavery issue, and the beast did not stop yelping until drowned in the blood of the Civil War. Abolitionists assailed the Mexican conflict as one provoked by Southern slavocracy for its own evil purposes. As Jane Russell Lowell had Hosea Bigelow draw on his Yankee dialect, "They just want this California, so to lug new slave states in, to abuse ye and to scorn ye, and to plunder ye like sin." Because that's how we all talk up here. In line with Lowell's charge, the bulk of the American volunteers were admittedly from the South and Southwest, but as in the case of the Texas Revolution, the basic explanation was proximity rather than conspiracy. Quarreling over slavery extension also erupted on the floors of Congress. In 1846, shortly after the shooting started, Polk had requested an appropriation of $2 million with which to buy a peace. Representative David Wilmot of Pennsylvania, fearful of the Southern slaveocracy, introduced a fateful amendment. It stipulated that slavery should never exist in any of the territory to be wrested from Mexico. The disruptive Wilmot Amendment twice passed the House, but not the Senate. Southern members, unwilling to be robbed of prospective slave states, fought the restriction tooth and nail. Anti-slavery men in the Congress and out battled no less bitterly for the exclusion of slaves. The Wilmot Proviso, eventually endorsed by the legislatures of all but one of the free states, soon came to symbolize the burning issue of slavery in the territories. In a broad sense, the opening shots of the Mexican War were the opening shots of the Civil War. President Polk left the nation the splendid physical heritage of California and the Southwest, but also the ugly moral heritage of an embittered slavery dispute. Mexico will poison us, said the philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson. Even the great champion of the South, John C. Calhoun, had prophetically warned that Mexico is to us the forbidden fruit. The penalty of eating it would be to subject our institutions to political death. Mexicans could later take some satisfaction in knowing that the territory wrenched from them. Sure. I know. I'm trying to read. What do you think? All right.
I want to eat up there.
Mexico could take later some satisfaction in knowing that the territory wrenched from them had proved to be venomous apple of discord that could well be called Santa Ana's revenge.